Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Today my guest is Recluse, aka Steven Snyder. First, a couple of announcements. If you have a business, product, podcast, or you're making a film, offering a service, is there anything you would like to showcase or advertise on a large scale? Advertise with Forbidden Knowledge News. Email me, forbiddennowledgenews@gmail.com. You get all the details and options that gives you the most effective ads and promotions possible. Check out our website, which is forbiddenknowledge.news. This is also the home of the Forbidden Knowledge Network. That's where you find some of your favorite podcasts featured from our community. Forbidden Knowledge News is always on Rockfin, Odyssey, Rumble, and all podcast platforms. And our social media is Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Go check us out on Rockfin. Sign up. This is where you get our premium content. You also get all the premium content from every creator that is there on Rockfin. Just go to rockfin.com/FKN+ or click the link in the description. All those links are right there. Today I want to welcome back to the show Recluse, a.k.a. Steven Snyder. He is an author and longtime curator of the Vise Up website, which is dedicated to parapolitics and high weirdness in all their many forms. After nearly a decade in the blogging racket, he's branched out into podcasts. With Frank Zero of Zero Night, he co-hosts The Form, which is a weekly podcast dedicated to parapolitics and synchromysticism. Steven, welcome back. How you doing?
I'm doing well, sir. How are you doing today?
Excellent, man. I can't complain. Been looking forward to this. We're going to get weird. We're going to get into some werewolf lore, origins, Lupercalia Festival, and much more high strangeness that you've been looking into. You always dive deep into your research, so I know this is going to be a good talk. But it has been a while since you've been on. Before we get into any of this, just remind the audience a bit about yourself and what you got going on.
Well, I was the longtime curator of the Vise Up blog going back to like 2010, I think, or something like that. I did that for quite a few years, eventually got into podcasting back around 2019, 2020. I hosted the Farm podcast, which I took over from Frank Zero. You can now find that in Apple and Spotify under the Farm podcast Mach 2. And then also I got the Patreon, where you get two additional full-length shows per month, plus a lot of other goodies, updates on my ongoing investigations, State of the Union addresses, periodic essays, just, you know, all kinds of pretty crazy stuff that I cook up, even periodic videos and so forth. So, but yeah, I basically have just been kind of traveling around the country a lot for the last year, year and a half, sort of on this ongoing process of self-initiation, if you will. It's taken me to a lot of incredible places. I've met a lot of incredible people, seen a lot of incredible things, and Hopefully in a few years, it's going to produce a couple of projects to kind of document all the incredible things that have come out of this.
Right on. Now, I want to ask you something before we get into werewolves. I've heard you discuss one time a psychedelic experience that you had where you actually you walked into some place and you were able to see these gray aliens walking around. Would you be able to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. That was actually the first time I took magic mushrooms. This was back like probably 03, 2004 thereabouts. I was living at the dorms at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs, and Colorado Springs is not the best town for psychedelics in general. Of course, you don't know, like NORAD is there, but it was also for a long time like the headquarters of Focus on the Family. I mean, when I lived there in like 03, 04, you would actually see people saying prayers over their Big Macs at McDonald's, for lunch. I mean, that kind of stuff. It was
Yeah, I
just
actually
creepy,
live in Fort
man.
Collins. I just went on a vacation through Colorado Springs to that little spiritual town in Crestone. But yeah, I'm right around that area sometimes.
Yeah, no, it is a gnarly area. I mean, I love Garden of the Gods,
Yeah,
and
yeah.
obviously, you're only about an hour or something like that from Denver, so they're on my nightstand. Anyway, like I'm living on this dorm at the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs. Took psychedelic mushrooms for the first time. It's a pretty standard trip, like up to that point. But then I'm kind of getting to what I'm thinking is the end of it. Like it's around 11 o'clock or something like that. And one of the cool things about the dorm is they did this like late night meal in the cafeteria, from like 10:30 to midnight or something, where they would kind of do like some light breakfast stuff and just things like that. So I was like, yeah, all right, maybe I'll go grab like some eggs or something like that before I turn in. So go in, walk into the section of the cafeteria where they feed you. It's like kind of like a buffet setup. They've got food spread out. They got kind of like the back, the area in the back where they've got the stove and the cook and everything. It's all like white and whatnot. And as I walk in there, I mean, it's like almost covered in fog or something like that. Like there's a smoke machine in the place. And I see these like 6, 7 foot tall gray aliens just kind of like walking around in this cafeteria area, like amongst the students, like observing them and what have you. And they're just, the students just going about putting stuff on their plates. I mean, all this other good stuff. And yeah, it was the most intense, well, I won't say the most intense psychedelic experience, but I've never had visuals like that before, since I actually don't really get visuals very much when I trip, maybe like some trails or something here and there. I mean,
Right.
occasionally I see like the walls move, that kind of stuff, but I mean, nothing like that. We're just seeing like actual, beings there. Like, I mean, like they were really, literally physically standing there. It was definitely something else. And like I tell people a lot, that was kind of like the thing that really kicked me off into this journey in the first place, because I started wondering then, have people seen extraterrestrials and other psychedelic states, or also kind of other altered states of consciousness? And that's when I start looking into things like remote viewing and all this other good stuff. So.
Yeah, it just reminded me of a psychedelic experience I had because I'm the same way. I don't usually get visuals, nothing really profound, but this one experience I had, my ex-girlfriend shapeshifted into a huge reptilian in front of my face and was
Really,
chasing me
really.
around my house, and my whole house became like this dungeon. It was insane. And by the end of the experience, I was puking up black stuff, and it was like some kind of exorcism experience. But yeah, it's some crazy stuff. But I was gonna ask if you thought you were just perceiving a different type of spectrum or different reality that we can't normally see, and that's where these beings reside.
Yeah, no, I think that was like very much the case. I mean, I've had several other experiences like that too, where I felt like I was kind of touched by things on the other side or something like that. But I mean, yeah, I do think that, we do periodically have these kinds of encounters where we either see something from the other side, or sometimes we maybe even perhaps go into another dimension or something of that effect.
Yeah, man, that's pretty crazy. All right, let's get into werewolves. What got you into looking into werewolf lore and werewolves in general?
Well, it wasn't the lore so much. It was the movies, man, because I'm a big horror buff,
Oh,
right?
yeah.
So And I've always kind of found vampires to be like overrated. I mean, I like zombie stuff, but I mean, there's only so much you can do with zombies. And I mean, really, once you've seen like 28 Days, Romero's Night of the Living Dead movies, I mean, like Shaun of the Dead, Return of the Living Dead, a few of the others, I mean, that's Dead Alive. That's pretty much it, you know? But werewolves were always fascinating to me, and it seemed like they were kind of criminally underused for a lot of years by Hollywood, especially when you kind of see like in comparison to the zombie or vampire films. Though as I've gotten older, it kind of occurred to me, well, J.G. Michael actually pointed it out to me, that it's probably more of a budgetary thing, you know. I mean, for a lot of years before the, you know, the CGI era, I mean, it actually cost a pretty good amount of coin to do a decent werewolf transformation. Not so much now, maybe, but you know, that was probably a hindrance, I would say, for a lot of years. So anyway, even though there's not like a ton of werewolf movies from sort of the era that I grew up in with horror, like the 70s, 80s, 90s, a lot of them are really freaking good, man. You know, there's American Werewolf in London, there's Silver Bullet, the Ginger Snaps movies. You could maybe kind of throw Ravenous in there. A Wolf with Jack Nicholson, Bad Moon Rising. But the one that, oh, I'm in the Company of Wolves, that's another great one, Neil Jordan. But the one, man, that I always fixated on was The Howling.
I saw
Love
that
The
like
Howling.
of last month, I think. That's interesting.
Oh, awesome, awesome. Well, I probably might be able to give you some insights into you have things you hadn't noticed before then, because it's a really cool movie. I'm a huge Joe Dante fan, who's the director. For those of you unaware, he's the guy who did both of the Gremlins movies, Matinee, which is another one of my all-time favorite movies, and The Burbs, actually, for that matter. I love Joe Dante. He's directed a lot of my favorite movies, and John Sayles is an unbelievable screenwriter. He later got into directing a lot more serious affair like Mate Juan, The Curse of Ruin Ishmael, I think is what it was called. I know there was like, oh, Lone Star, Men with Guns. He's done a lot of like more art house movies, Brother from Another Planet, probably a lot of other stuff I'm forgetting. But I've seen The Howling just dozens of times. And it was actually kind of one of those movies the first time where I really kind of started to like become aware that there was this very elaborate subtext to the movie, a lot of just strange things about it that played into some of the intrigues that were going on in California in the 70s and 80s. And you know, just like for those of you unaware, probably going to be some spoilers here, but the pretext of the movie is this lady is tracking a serial killer, this reporter. She and it helps the police hunt him down, but it's a very traumatic experience for her. She has kind of an emotional breakdown, and then she ends up going off to this kind of self-help retreat in Northern California. The first part of it takes place kind of, I think, in the LA area, when she's tracking the serial killer. And as she gets up there, she finds out a lot of incredible things, namely that her psychiatrist who runs the thing and who brought her up there is the head of a cult of werewolves that essentially operates as a kind of secret society. And the serial killer that she had been tracking was a member of this cult who had left and gone down to LA. So there was just a lot of like insane stuff with this. Another thing that's really interesting is the serial killer Eddie that you find out is a werewolf. Like he has a calling card, right, that he leaves to all the detectives and stuff at the crime scenes. Do you remember what that is?
I can't remember what that is right now.
It's a smiley face.
Okay.
And this movie, again, you got to remember, was made in 1980. Okay, the smiley face killings didn't start to get acknowledged until like the mid-90s. And even before then, like the happy face killer, that didn't really start until like the late 80s or something like that. So, as far as I know, this was actually the first time like a serial killer was linked to using like the smiley face as a calling card, which is another one of the really intriguing things about it. And then on top of that, you know, you have just sort of all the, I think, ties to many of these sort of strange communes that were being set up in Northern California in the late 90s. I mean, I'm thinking specifically some of the stuff with the Church of All World, And the bard that was connected to them, Gwendolyn Pounderwind or something like that. Of course, he had that one compound that was right next to the one the Church of the All World was using. And there were just so many curious characters in that milieu. I mean, obviously, Walter Breen and his wife, Marion Zimmer Bradley, were affiliated with them through like the Society of Creative Anachronisms and things like that. Breen, of course, was the infamous pedophile. Who had actually molested his own daughter. He was big in like the science fiction community for a lot of years, which is where he usually kind of prey on kids at cons and things like that. And his wife was the author of The Mists of Avalon. It was a really damning expose of them, written by their daughter Moira Greyland, The Last Closet, which I highly recommend, but it's a very
I was
intense
listening
read.
to that audio book on my vacation last week.
Yeah, you know what I'm talking about. It's
Yeah.
not an easy thing to get through. So, and then of course, it's not really talked about a lot, but Leonard Lake, the infamous serial killer, was actually also living on Gwendolyn's compound there in Northern California. And then of course later he would relocate. This was where he met his wife, by the way, was on the compound with the bard. And then of course he would later relocate to the other isolated region in Northern California when he and Charles Negg started abducting women and whatnot. But so anyway, this is like that whole sort of, I think, climate that had inspired the werewolf cult in The Howling. So this, certainly brings up a lot of interesting ties. I mean, some of the speculations about serial killer cults and what have you being nationwide. And again, it's, I think, important to emphasize that Sayles and Dante were doing this, like 1979, 1980, I mean, when it came out. So, I mean, a lot of this stuff was before, things like the Ultimate Evil and what have you had really entered into like the pop culture. I mean, obviously the Ultimate Evil hadn't even been released at this point, but it was before a lot of this kind of these sort of notions had entered into the popular sphere. It's kind of like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the OG one. I mean, if you go back and watch it, there's a lot of interesting kind of echoes of what later developed with Henry Lee Lucas and the Matamoros cult and things like that. So yeah, I mean, some of these horror movies from the 70s definitely have some fascinating subtext like that.
Oh yeah, those are
But
my
anyway.
favorites, 70s and 80s. That's the best era for horror to me.
No, absolutely, absolutely. But anyway, so there, I was already aware of the fact that there was just so much insane stuff in this movie, The Howling. And I mean, I could just go on with some of the occult allusions. I mean, that the whole bookstore scene in it with Dick Miller, where he gets the silver bullets at. I mean, good goodness, there's just so much crap in that whole scene alone that you could do like a whole show practically on. I mean, just analyzing some of the stuff they put in the backdrop.
Yeah.
But in recent, I mean, in the last couple of months, I had actually started to realize that there was a really specific reason, I think, as to why they had even opted to use werewolves for this particular storyline, because you wouldn't necessarily even, need them to be werewolves. I mean, they could have been vampires, they could have just been a Manson-like kind of cult or something like that, or maybe later, Santeria practitioners or something like that. But I think that there was actually a specific reason, which oddly also kind of ties into psychedelics and maybe even seeing things in another dimension or something. That's kind of why the lizard thing that you brought up is interesting.
Yeah.
So,
All right. Well, let's get into some werewolf origins and European tradition, how this all originated.
well, this goes way back. And it's kind of rooted in a concept that's variously been known as, I think it's the Kuros, or in more recent times, the Minnerbund. Minnerbund isn't necessarily preferred nowadays because of its, association with Nazism. But the whole concept, though, has been kind of toyed around with anthropologists for a while now. There was some debate as the existence of this whole sort of order, but now it seems pretty conclusive, especially after gosh, I can't remember. There was the one site that was found like in the steppes, I believe, like around modern day Ukraine or something like that, with all the dog and wolf sacrifice remains that really drove home the reality of these whole institutions. But okay, so what I'm getting at with this is that within
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
From what we can tell, the Indo-European group, and again, this is always a touchy subject. I mean, as far, again, as far as we can tell, this is mainly just sort of a name of a language, more or less. It wasn't necessarily tied to an ethnicity, but it was more or less the language and the culture that predominated in that particular region of the world at the time, not unlike maybe you could say in North America with like the Hopewell or the Adena tribes. I mean, the Hopewell, especially is kind of a catch-all. There were a lot of different tribes that are quite unique that fall under that label, but there are certain sort of unifying things and language and cultural beliefs that has led us to lump them together, such as the traditions of the mountains and so forth. And it kind of seems like it was something similar like that with the Indo-Europeans. But anyway, one of the traditions that has just appeared so often through dispersion was this whole concept of the Kuros or Minerbund or whatever you want to call it. And effectively, this amounted to the use of a lot of noble families, usually not necessarily the eldest sons, but like the minor aristocrats, who were more or less sent out into the wilderness to live for a period of time during the year. Typically, it was around 6 months or something like that. A lot of times, this stuff was closely related to the winter solstices and the summer solstices and all that kind of stuff, usually celebrations of New Year's and so forth. But a lot of times they sent the lads out at a time when the weather wasn't especially good, food was scarce. So now, the elders in the city will be well provided for, and coincidentally too, there'll also be a greater ratio of women to men as well, why most of the men in the prime of their youth have been sent outside of the city. And more or less, they had to survive out there on the land. They foregoed all their possessions other than their weapons. And the big thing that they did, were basically violate social norms. They would go out, they would steal, they would murder, they would rape, they would pillage other villages. That was really the only real restraint. You didn't, loot your home village. You didn't attack the community that you came from. But every other community was fair game. And these guys were usually trained in military tactics. Typically, there were a couple of elders that were out there with them too, who were sort of like the keepers of this tradition. And they would train them in military tactics and so forth, so that when they when the city or whatever went to war formally, you would usually have like the conventional forces, and then these kids would be used as essentially proto kind of special operations forces. They would engage in, what we think of now as like unconventional warfare.
During what time period was this again?
This is very early, man. This is like, gosh, I mean, I don't. This would have been like at the dawn, really, of civilization around India, like in the very, this is like theoretically before the Brahmins, the priest class, had even really become like the highest stratosphere of society, if you will. Because there are some theories, again, it's been debated, but it's kind of thought that originally the warrior caste was the highest one, and they were sort of more these, kind of Jedi or Sith-like, warrior monks or something to that effect. And then it was only later that the Brahmins were elevated above them. But this would have been in sort of the era where the warrior caste really had precedent, and you had, sort of like the former military units, like in later, you know, kind of setups like this. It was this institution was really big in Sparta, for instance. And Sparta, you had like the former Hoplites, and then you had their own version of the Curios, who would have been like these kids who were like the guerrilla fighters and so forth that would have been used. And it's kind of interesting, you know, with like this spiritual dynamic. You know, if you want to get into it, maybe going back to the earlier times, you could almost see the conventional forces as being kind of like the Jedi Knights, and then these guys would be more like the Sith or something, because they were kind of doing the dark side of combat, the night side of combat. And another one of the things that they were known for, and this is sort of where the berserker, the tradition of the warrior berserkers of Norse culture comes from, is that they fought naked, except for frequently they would drape themselves in wolf skins. Okay. And another thing they would do in combat in a lot of cases would be to take some kind of psychedelic before they went into combat, because what they actually wanted to do was be possessed by a god when they were going into the field of battle. And that, you know, and taking some kind of like mushroom was usually seen as the easiest way of accomplishing this. I mean, obviously there were a lot of other, you know, depending upon the culture, I mean, sometimes they would go into self-harm, or I mean, dance movements, fasting, I mean, all kinds of things that would put them in an altered state of consciousness. But I mean, you know, you wanted to be possessed by something like Ares or Dionysus or something like that when you were going into battle, from like the perspective of like maybe the Greco-Roman world. And, you know, these guys were basically described as fighting, you know, just uncontrollably. I mean, like I said, this is where the whole tradition of the berserkers were, you know, coming from. They thought they were possessed. And, I mean, obviously, they would have struck quite a sight. I mean, these were all young men in the prime of their youth. They would have been draped out in these wolf skins, tripping out with, like, their axes and stuff like that. And it kind of goes into the tradition of the werewolves. I mean, a lot of people think that this is maybe where it initially came from, but I'm kind of reminded of what you were talking about, because sometimes, you know, people would report seeing them in battle turning into wolves and whatnot. So it's kind of like a question of like, were they really being possessed by something? And maybe in the context of battle, because I mean, obviously, you know, even soldiers going into, you know, combat that aren't tripping or whatever, I mean, they get wounded. I mean, they get, you know, overheated and stuff like that. There's plenty of things, you know, shell shock, all kinds of stuff that could potentially send them into an altered state of consciousness as well. So were they possibly catching a glimpse of maybe what was entering into these forces? Mm. What was controlling them? I mean, who knows? But it's right. Interesting.
That kind of links with the Skinwalker lore as well.
Yeah. Well, it's especially interesting because from what we can tell, the original deity for this seems to have been a kind of like wolf god that was worshipped in a lot of cases. And this is why it's kind of believed that a reoccurring custom was to sacrifice wolves or dogs from these warriors. And in earlier times, it may well have been that, you know, there, from what we can tell, there was this strange kind of game that came from India that they would do. It was sort of a dice game involving nuts or something like that. And you would have like a stack of 50 that you would put down. You would grab handfuls at a time, and whoever was left with, I think, one or something like that, would have basically become like the leader, and he would be inhabited by the wolf god, and then he would be ritualistically sacrificed. But it's interesting because the person who killed him was sort of known basically as the dog killer, and he became a sort of scapegoat-esque figure almost. By killing the wolf god, he would take on the sins of the rest of the warriors effectively, and kind of becomes like an antagonistic figure. And just if you guys have ever seen Under the Silver Lake, I'm guessing a lot of people listening to this probably have. Yeah, I very much think that the whole dog killer stuff in that movie is a reference to this, actually. So there's a lot of creepy stuff about that. Yeah.
Well, moving a little bit forward in history, there's some connections with the Roman festival of Lupercalia, right?
Yeah. Well, first, it kind of goes into the whole concept of Arcadia, which was a city-state in Greece. Very fascinating place on a lot of levels. On the one hand, this is in tradition where worship of Pan originated from, which I found very interesting among other things, because Pan has enjoyed such a robust resurgence in the modern world. I mean, especially, in like the whole sort of Hellier, Pennyroyal crowd, but it seems like you've been seeing more and more of Pan in a lot of other contexts in recent years. But anyway, Pan theoretically originated from Arcadia, and there were these other traditions that were handed down, essentially, that the mountain there, I can't remember what it's called now off the top of my head, but that this had been the original place that the gods had inhabited before they had gone to Olympus, because historically there had also been the sort of versions of Zeus and Apollo that were linked to Arcadia as well. But as the story goes, the king of Arcadia, Lycon, had decided to offer up a very unique sacrifice to Zeus. He decided to sacrifice his own son and then cannibalize him in a feast for Zeus and the other gods. And Zeus was so outraged by this that he turned Lycon into a wolf. And that was sort of where the whole Greek tradition of the werewolf originated from. But from what we can tell, the three principal deities of Arcadia, and they all sort of had this Lycois honorific at the end of their names, Pan Lycois, Zeus Lycois, Apollo Lycois, they seem like they were basically different representations or personas of what had been the original god there, which was, again, essentially more of a wolf-like god. It kind of plays into some of the different depictions of Pan too. I mean, usually Pan is depicted as sort of like a goat human hybrid, but there's definitely the kind of wolf version of Pan as well that you periodically see. I think that's kind of a remnant from an older tradition involving Pan. But yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating thing. So you had like this whole custom of, or this belief that there had been human sacrifice committed at Arcadia, and this was pretty widely held in the ancient world. I mean, Plato, for instance, gets into this in the Republic, and there are several other prominent historical sources that address it, which is interesting because, I mean, Arcadia is so revered, really, just so many different scenes throughout the world. I mean, there's always been this, kind of obsession with recreating the new Arcadia. Of course, there's the famous painting from the Renaissance with the two shepherds and the skulls. Was it Eckhart in it to Arcadium or something like that? But yeah, so it's something that's very much fixated Western culture for a long time, and it's very closely tied to the werewolf myths. And as I came to find out, it was also very closely tied to ancient Rome as well. In some traditions, Evander, who was an Arcadian, relocated to Italy and settled in the region that is now Rome. And he built a town, I think it was Placidian or something like that. I can't recall off the top of my head. It was by the Palatine Hill. And this was supposedly, the guy who brought the worship of the Greek gods and the Greek laws and the Greek alphabet and all this other stuff to Italy. I mean, he's, I mean, almost like a Hermes type figure or something like that in ancient Rome. And this led to a lot of interesting traditions around the Palatine Hill, to put it mildly. Of course, it later became really closely tied to Romulus and Remus, which I'll get to in a second. But there's a cave there, the Lupercal, I think, that had been there for a very long time, and it was said to be sacred to Pan. But this was the Roman version of Pan, who was known as Faunus, and he was kind of perceived as almost like this hidden god of Rome. Like he was really big in the early days, but they didn't like talking about him. It's very interesting. And later, it was said that the she-wolf that suckled Romulus and Remus lived out of the same cave. So it's also, again, this sort of connection with wolves and this Pan-like figure, where it kind of seems like in the original incarnation, it was probably more of a wolf god than maybe a goat human hybrid, or maybe even something more akin to a werewolf or something to that effect. And another interesting thing about the Palatine Bill, too, is eventually, well, from very early on, they had a shrine at the top to Victoria, who is essentially Pallas Athenia slash Minerva and her, warrior goddess persona. Of course, she's later been adopted as the model for Columbia and a lot of other contemporary things in the New World, which we'll probably get to here in a little bit. But her big shrine in ancient Rome was at the top of the Palatine Hill, and there was a lot of notoriety around the newer one that they put up around 296 BC. This was occurring during the time, I think they were at war with the Gauls, but I can't remember exactly. But anyway, the Romans were basically getting their asses kicked. So, you're getting your ass kicked in war, right? Who are you going to look to? Well, you're going to look to Victoria. I mean, the goddess of war, victory, obviously. So we've offered up all the sacrifices we can think of. We've done the bulls and the goats and all this other shit. Nothing's working. So, well, there's one thing left we could try. We could sacrifice somebody. I mean, we're building the new temple up there. It means human sacrifices to consecrate a new building have always been popular. Well, hell, what do we got to lose? I mean, we're getting slaughtered in the field of battle. Why not? That's what they did. We've even found evidence of that with bodies being recovered there in a cemetery that appears to have been very basically to have like marble or something put over it that they were trying to cover up. So this is one of the only times in Roman history that we know of where they actually engaged in human sacrifice, and it became a really taboo and touchy thing for the Romans from here on out. And this also, kind of appears to have been the time when the Romulus and the Remus mythos really starts to emerge as well, establishing them as the founders of Rome. And there's some speculation that Romulus murdering his brother Remus was a kind of cultural, or a kind of memory, if you will, of when they had done these sacrifices, these human sacrifices on top of the Palatine Hill, and kind of the cultural trauma that the budding Roman society had experienced through going through that process. Because it was something even for years afterwards, it was like kind of debated, should we have really have done that? Because they kind of continued to have misfortunes afterwards. And there's this thinking like, well, maybe the human sacrifice thing really wasn't that good of an ideal after all. So getting into like this, the whole tradition around like Romulus and Remus and what have you. One of the things that Romulus did was establish like an order of equites or knights or something like that, which were closely associated with him. Again, these were guys like on horseback and so forth, and they were, not necessarily given the most romanticized depictions and historical accounts, even among the Romans themselves. They were basically described as brigands who went around the countryside looting and pillaging other city-states. And this would have been the group Romulus also theoretically led to carry off the Sibylline women, I think is what it was called. The women that they essentially stole from this other city-state and then raped and impregnated and turned into their wives so that they could repopulate Rome or something to that effect. So there's a lot of striking parallels to the sort of mythological foundation or to the mythos around Romulus that seems to eerily parallel the tradition of the Kuros or the Minnerbund or whatever you want to call it. I mean, especially with the close association with wolves, the fact that he was suckled on the wolf, the carrion birds, all this other kind of stuff. So the thinking is possibly that there really was this connection to Arcadia, because again, Arcadia, because of the fact that there seems to have been a wolf god or something like that, it might have also been related to these traditions. Because one of the things, sort of going way back, is that besides going out and pillaging, in some cases, these warrior bands, were never even allowed to return home. So they would just establish like their own colonies and so forth. And then, they would kick their sons out and they would go out and establish their colonies and so on and so forth. So, I mean, it's kind of, some thinking like when you had the, I think it was the Dorians who invaded ancient Greece and really kind of fundamentally changed the culture. There's a lot of thinking that they came from the steppes and they were part of the sort of Indo-European cultural milieu. Maybe this was an instance of these Minerbuns coming into a region and starting new colonies or taking over city-states. And this process might have been ongoing for centuries, which is why this institution seems to appear over and over again throughout Europe and the Near East and all these other places. So it raises the possibility that Arcadia was a colony that was set up in this fashion, and possibly Rome too. So
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right, ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus
terms and conditions apply. See website for details. Was there evidence of that going into more recent times? And it definitely seems like there was. And that was in the Lupercalia, which was a really big festival that the Romans had on February 15th in our calendar. And then they had kind of an additional one that would have been on February 17th, which was dedicated to Quintrius, I think. That was Romulus in his sort of deified god form or something like that. But the tradition with that was very fascinating. Essentially, as it went, Romulus had set up these two collegii, which were still in existence, well up into the time of Caesar. I think, I mean, it pretty much continued into the conversion of Christianity. But you had these two collegii or colleges, whatever you want to call them. They were overseen by these respective magistrates, and they had always been associated specifically with these two noble Roman families, the Fabii and the Quintius, I think is how it was pronounced. So these two families, very old Roman nobility, and they would continue to play significant roles in the Republic and the Empire, I think pretty much up to, yeah, I mean, almost the time of Constantine that we know of. And who knows? I mean, this might be one of these two instances of these Roman families that never totally left us, but whatever. So these guys are for almost time immemorial associated with these two colleges, and they're the ones that are tasked with overseeing Lupercalia, this big festival. And it's very interesting. These colleges were pretty much made up exclusively of men between the ages of 20 and 40. And when they did the Lupercalia, they would sacrifice a goat, which is very interesting. And then they would go around the streets with, it's not quite whips, but something kind of similar to that. And they would go out and just randomly start striking people and stuff, and especially women. Women were usually singled out for special targeting and things like that. And we kind of think that this was sort of like a reenactment of how these warrior bands would have been back in the old days. You know, they would have done their sacrifices and then they would have gone out and assaulted people. Of course, back then they would have, you know, actually gone out and raped them or something like that. But, you know, I mean, this is the refinement of it. Now we just go around and whip them, you know, like, yeah. The Lupercalia seems like it's the fact that it was a very ancient Roman festival. It was connected to two of the oldest aristocratic families who had overseen it for just centuries seems to strongly indicate that there was this interesting tie-in that Rome may well have begun as a colony of a Kuros band or something like that. And they had these traditions of this sort of primordial wolf god that was later kind of grafted onto Pan worship.
And there may have been different groups or secret societies that brought this tradition over in the New World.
Well, yes, that's when we get into one of my personal favorites. It's known as the Society of Cincinnati. Mm. It was the first chivalric order established in the United States right after the country had basically gained its independence from Britain. Set up by George Washington himself and a lot of the officers who had engaged in his Continental Army. And it was originally structured where you could only get in by being a hereditary member of the families of the officers in his army, though later it was amended to also let in honorary members. And there were quite a few major figures in early America that were in this. It was really quite aristocratic. I mean, besides Washington, you also had like Alexander Hamilton. Andrew Jackson was later admitted into it. A lot of like the big Dutch banking families, like the von Rosensteins, I think, and the Livingstones, the Schuylers. I mean, all of these families were a part of it. The Huntington family, which was just instrumental. Really, they're actually probably still a power to this day, but they were huge in creating Mormonism, Skull and Bones, just a lot of other of these groups. But this is really the beginning, I think, of a lot of the major you know, New World dynasties here. And you would later see groups like the DuPonts and the Vanderbilts also brought into the Society of Cincinnati. In fact, the Society of Cincinnati's headquarters in Washington, D.C. Is right there in DuPont Circle, which is really interesting.
Makes me wonder how many of these groups kept human sacrifice as a part of the tradition there.
Well, actually, I just did a whole thing on how I think Alexander, the Burr-Hamilton duel, because Aaron Burr was also a member of the Society of Cincinnati, and I actually do think that the Burr-Hamilton duel was a kind of ritualistic sacrifice that was based on that whole concept I was just telling you of the dog killer. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, Burr almost took on that whole sort of persona of like the national scapegoat. But it's really fascinating because, again, there were so many members of the Society of Cincinnati that were involved in that. And actually, like literally the week before Burr and Hamilton fought the duel, when they had already agreed to the duel, when they were supposedly in the midst of this feud, they went to a party the Society of Cincinnati was throwing for 4th of July, and they literally sat right next to each other at the table in both in places of honor. And they did 17 toasts. If you know the tarot deck, 17 is closely associated with dogs because of the star card, Artemis, and what have you. And then at one point, Hamilton got up and he sang a tune that was popularly known as Wolf's Song to the audience gathered around. And it's interesting because Hamilton was in a really good mood for this, whereas Burr was uncharacteristically moody and silent. But there's just a lot of fascinating stuff with this. And the Society of Cincinnati is a big deal. It was behind creating the Federalist Party, which was the first, you know, real political party in the country. And then later it gained quite a considerable foothold in the Democratic Republicans, too. I mean, Washington, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, their administrations were just dominated by Society of Cincinnati members. The Society of Cincinnati was actually really big in pushing the Illuminati scare in New England. And that went into all the intrigues with their French section, which they had, and people like Lafayette and Pierre Lefond, you know, the designer of Washington, D.C., were all members of the Society of Cincinnati's French section. But overwhelmingly, they were all drawn from the ranks of the Knights of Malta, like the, you know, the actual Knights of Malta, going back to the Knights Hospitaller, if what have you. So this is the Society of Cincinnati's French section. And during this time, i.e. during the French Revolution, I mean, there were a lot of intrigues playing out between them and members of the Illuminati over there. So it's really fascinating that in the States, you know, you had members of the Society of Cincinnati that were whipping up the Illuminati scare in the country and just all kinds of other insane stuff. Yeah. But I mean, they seem to have basically have been the ones who started Shay's Rebellion, because besides the fact that the officers who put down Shay's Rebellion were all Society of Cincinnati members, almost all of Shay's like upper echelon officers were Society of Cincinnati members too. And this provided the pretext for the Constitutional Convention that led to the Constitution. I mean, that's possibly the first real false flag in the history of the country. It was used to bring about the Constitution. And this group, the Society of Cincinnati, is at the heart of this. This is something like on my Patreon section I've done a ton of work on, if you guys are more interested in this, but it's a really fascinating topic. Yeah. But okay, so where did the Society of Cincinnati get its name from? Well, it took it from a Roman general who was supposedly revered by these officers because he was made a dictator in Rome. And Rome periodically, when they appointed somebody to be a dictator, it was basically to be a military poobah. You know, I mean, if the city was really being threatened, you had one guy who basically took over management of everything so he could mobilize the entire community for war and, you know, get this taken care of. And that's what this guy, Cincinnatus, did. He was supposedly, you know, this patriarch or aristocrat who had his farms out in the countryside, and they appointed him dictator, and he assumed absolute power over Rome, and he went out and he beat the shit out of this one barbarian horde, and then he came back and he gave up all his powers, and he went back to plow his fields and fuck his slaves. And he was, you know, always revered in ancient Rome, and then later in the United States amongst the founding fathers. But see, it's really interesting because his full name was Lucius Quintus Cincinnatus, and he was a member of that same family that ran one of the colleges for the Lupercala, which means he would have been part of the Lupercia, the brother of the wolf. And the fact that he was considered one of the major patriarchs of that family also raises the strong possibility that he was even a magistrate, which was essentially the equivalent of a grand master in these colleges. So when you start kind of sitting back and looking at the Society of Cincinnati, because if you'll recall, Romulus, you know, instituted his own order of knighthood in Rome. They were known as the Equites or something like that. I know I'm butchering the pronunciation on that, but you know, later on, I kind of think that the European orders of knighthood were essentially attempts to recreate the whole concept of the manor bone. I mean, that's, I don't want to get like too far sidetracked with that, but I mean, there's always been like this close association with this kind of thing. So I have begun to wonder where, you know, officers in Washington's military aware of these kinds of connections. And even before I had started to make these associations with Hamilton, I had gone to the Society of Cincinnati's headquarters at DC to look around, and it's just overwhelming with some of the occulted stuff that they've got in there. It really is. But one thing that really stood out to me were these series of tapestries that they had up. And it's showing this goddess with her hounds, who I would say is supposed to be Columbia, because they've got stuff to Columbia everywhere in this place. And she's hunting Pan. And this is really weird, because again, you know, in the classical myths, this would be Artemis, and she would have gotten her dogs from Pan. Pan was like her close ally. Mm. And here she's going around hunting him. And for a long time, I had puzzled over this, you know, but they had these reliefs really prominently displayed. And I mean, there's kind of hints of this stuff at other things that they have up throughout the headquarters, and kept wondering why this particular image. And then when I had started, though, looking into the Lupercalia, the stuff that was happening with that, I mean, if you'll recall, they sacrificed a goat. Okay, and the colleges are based out at the Palatine Hill, right around the Lupercal, the cave, and you know where the she-wolf was, the one that was sacred to Faunus and what have you. And you've got the Shrine to Victoria atop this hill, where they actually did do the human sacrifices, right? So it kind of begs the question, you know, what was this tradition of the goat sacrifice based off of? Was it possibly like an earlier one that also involved human sacrifice? But it seems like it also involved, you know, Pan later on. Mm-hmm. But if you sort of follow what I've been suggesting here, that in the early versions of like the Kyros, where you would have the leader who would take on the persona of the wolf god, and then there would be the dog killer, kind of makes more sense. Like, you know, somebody was eventually, or at some point, would take on the persona of Pan and Faunus, you know, the goat god, and they would be killed. And then later it just sort of became a simple goat. But yeah, so that kind of is what I think was being hinted at in these tapestries in DC. And again, it's really interesting with the DuPonts, because if you've ever been to the Noirs estate that they've got in Wilmington, Delaware, where our current president is having so many issues with certain documents that he stored in his house there, this estate, they have this garden there that's insane. I mean, one side of it, you've got Diana, the huntress there. And I mean, it's just a full-on shrine to the celestial hunt and what have you. So, you know, again, I have to just keep concluding that these families were aware of these traditions, because the celestial hunt, I mean, that's also very closely connected with the Minerbuns and all this other stuff. Mm. And again, a lot of the rumors about some of the communities in that area, I'm not going to get into it, but there's been in the Wilmington area a lot of speculation for years that there was some very shady stuff with kids that went on there.
Child trafficking, cults, satanic, ritualistic type of things going on.
I've been to a spot in that region that was very unnerving. It's a park. It's a public park that has no actual parking for it. I'm not going to name names, but I went back into this. It was just absolutely decked out in the trees with a lot of the cult markings. And this is a very... this park is kind of like in the middle of a suburb, and we went out there like in the early morning. It was very cold out. There's nobody out this park. Like I said, there's no public parking or anything around there. And within, you know, like about 10 minutes of us going wandering around, and there were like, I mean, 10, 15 people were just like sort of going wandering by us and what have you. I mean, almost instantly. So it was definitely like a place very much. It even felt like, you know, we were kind of being watched. It was just, it's kind of like, hey, it's a public area, but we don't really, you know, want outsiders here, you know, just, but so. Yeah, I mean, the DuPonts were later brought into the Society of Cincinnati, but these are the kinds of milieu that are connected to them. And yeah, there's a lot of weird stuff with that. And I mean, I'll do you one better, you know, I mean, some of the stuff with the mounds, right? So this is another thing the Society of Cincinnati was absolutely obsessed with, because they were the group that was really principally responsible for settling the Northwest Territory, which included most of modern-day Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, Indiana, Illinois, and so forth. And this is also where a lot of the major, or at least a lot of the most impressive mound structures in North America are located. I mean, you've got all the Effigy Mounds in Wisconsin. You've got like the Adena and the Hopewell ones in the Ohio Valley area, like the Great Serpent Mound and all this other stuff. And the Society of Cincinnati led a lot of the colony, the groups of colonists out into those areas to set up communities. When the Native Americans tried to push back with support from the British, it was Society of Cincinnati officers in the army who were sent out there to deal with it. In fact, it was good old Mad Wayne and his genocidal campaign that allowed us to secure, I think, Michigan. He was a big Society of Cincinnati member. So they were just huge in setting up all of this. And they established a city or a town, Marietta, Ohio. They had some of these burial mounds, and they established the first mound preservation society in the United States there around the early 19th century. I think it was like 1804 or something like that. And they would continue to play an enormous role in excavating and chronicling these mounds. George Washington himself was really obsessed with this, and he would constantly be getting reports in from a lot of Society of Cincinnati members as they check them out. And from what I can tell, too, I mean, you know, this is a really, in and of itself, bizarre topic, because the Smithsonian has done a lot to cover up what has been found in these mounds for a long time now. I mean, really, only a handful of people have ever been allowed to go down into them. Since, you know, like the 19th century, right? And it's only been really like a select group of archaeologists connected to the Smithsonian who primarily were the ones allowed to excavate them. And I know my colleague J.J. Vance feels strongly that most of those guys were connected to the Society of Cincinnati. So, you know, again, it's like the question of like, well, why was there all this obsession with the secrecy of this stuff? I mean, a lot of people assume that it was due to, you know, them finding like 7 foot tall skeletons or you know, Punic script or something like that in the mounds. But I, you know, kind of think there might have been a darker purpose to it. I think that part of the reason why this has been covered up was to cover up the extent of the genocide that was committed. And again, you know, if you accept that maybe some of these were holy sites to the Native Americans and they decided to do mass graves there. But again, it's also a disturbing parallel that you can draw to this Palatine Hill in Rome, where a lot of these traditions come from. Because again, you have this notion of human sacrifice on this sacred hill or mound dedicated to this goddess Victoria and this manifestation. And again, the Society of Cincinnati thing was Columbia.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
They named the capital of Ohio Columbus. Mm. They put it all over these areas. So this is something that I have very much had to ponder, or at least some of these mounds, sacrificial offerings that have been made. And that's one of the reasons why there's been this ongoing obsession with covering them up or just doing other bizarre things with them. I mean, like in another spot, it was like Mound City, which is near Chillicothe, Ohio. This was one of the largest mound sites in the whole Ohio Valley area. And they totally tore down all of these mounds. They later rebuilt like replicas of them, but they tore down the original mounds. And they used them to build a prison, which is directly next to this site. And this is actually really normal. I mean, okay, you've got the Grave Creek Mound in Wheeling, West Virginia, it's in Moundsville, which is near Wheeling. Okay, this is like the largest Edina mound, I think, that's still standing. It's like almost 50, 60 feet tall. It was allegedly where they found the Punic script in the 19th century. Okay, directly across the street, literally, like in the shadow of the mound, is the Moundsville prison. And if you've ever seen this thing, I mean, it is just absolutely evil incarnate. It literally looks like a gothic, you know, fortress or something like that. And this is where the state of West Virginia did its executions for almost like 100 years. I mean, up until the 1930s, they did public executions at this place. They would have people come out and do picnics and watch the prisoners get hanged in the back of this place. Okay. It was only stopped after somebody's head got torn off during the hangings. I guess that ruined somebody's Sunday lunch. And then, of course, the electric chair was at this prison. So the people afterwards were getting electrocuted. I mean, I think in the grand scheme of things, almost 2,000 people died at that prison in the course of it being open. So this is another thing that was built right across the street from a major holy site to the Native Americans. Again, people think that I'm possibly nuts by saying that, like, they might have done mass graves or some kind of ritual. I really don't think so, seeing just some of the stuff that's been built by these structures, having traveled across the country a lot, because it is a really creepy precedent that it just seems to turn up over and over again.
Yeah, man, that is some super creepy connections there. I want to get to your adventures in Wisconsin and some of the connections you found there before we close out.
Yeah. Well, again, Wisconsin, very much like a Society of Cincinnati state. I mean, you see that really represented in the Capitol with Madison. I mean, James Madison, again, was a member of the Society of Cincinnati. The Capitol building had a lot of influence. Well, also the city plan for Madison was based on the one that Lafont had done for Washington, D.C., member of the Society of Cincinnati. They got the good old, you know, the Statue to Columbia right on top of the dome of the Capitol. It was done by the same artist who did the one at the 1893 Chicago World's Fair. This guy was involved in a lot of projects related to the Society of Cincinnati. In fact, he actually designed those really striking statues that are outside the Alexander Hamilton Customs Building in New York City. If you've ever seen Ghostbusters 2, that's actually what they used as the exterior for Dana Barrett's museum, where they've got the picture of Vigo in. So those things are really great. But anyway, the main architect for the Capitol was John Neuer, who, again, was really closely connected to the Society of Cincinnati. In fact, he was actually tapped to establish a planned community in Marymount, right next to Cincinnati, by hereditary members of the Society of Cincinnati around the turn of the 20th century. So everything in that just whole very occulted Capitol was very closely tied to this. But interestingly enough, Wisconsin also has quite a reputation for werewolves too, right? You know, and as sure a lot of you probably know what I'm getting at with this, I'm talking about the Beast of Bray Road, which started to come up in like the late 1980s, early 90s, like when the flap first started to emerge with that. And it was basically centered around Elkhorn, Wisconsin, which is sort of in like the southeastern part of the state. It's, I don't know, probably like about an hour or something like that from Milwaukee. And there's this massive state park system, the Kettle Moraine, that's really, it's just enormous. I think it stretches all the way up into the Milwaukee area, almost up like into like Oshkosh region or something like that. It's just, it's huge. It's really nuts. And Elkhorn borders it like a lot of these other places. And this is where the infamous Bray Road is, you know, where they supposedly had these werewolf sightings and a lot of the surrounding area. So most recently, when I was in Wisconsin, I was with a couple of my buddies who had very much wanted to go see Elkhorn and see Bray Road. And I was like, well, okay, that's cool. But, you know, basically, we're just going to be driving on Bray Road. So let's see if there's something else cool we can do. And I knew about this place called Whitewater, which I decided I would take them to first because there's a lot of stuff to check out there. Whitewater's a really interesting town. It was set up in the late 19th century. And as the story goes, there was a coven of witches active there from the very beginning. And then later, the spiritualist church, the one based out of New York State, actually did establish a college there, the Morris Pratt Institute. And for a lot of years, this was the only spiritualist college operating in the whole world. And it's still active today in some incarnation, I believe, in Milwaukee. But anyway, so it's got this kooky spiritualist college, like right there. It's got this just really menacing looking water tower and the Sergian Park. I can't remember what it was called, but if you've ever seen this thing, I mean, it's huge. It was built in like 1890 when the town probably had, I don't know, like 300 people living in it or something. It just makes no sense. It's been surrounded by like a fence forever that looks like it was designed to keep something into it rather than out. And as the story goes, there are these three cemeteries in the town that form a perfect, what is it, quadrisis triangle or something like that. And they were known to be used by this coven of witches who would perform like human sacrifices at them. And specifically, I think the really notorious one was the Oak, which I can't remember what it's called, but it's the one that's like right next to the old school and not too far from this like water tower that I'm telling you apart. And there was a lot of other crazy stuff about this community too. Like it actually does have a network of underground tunnels, which were supposedly put in like during the Civil War for the part of the Underground Railroad. Even though actually I think the town was theoretically founded after the Civil War had wrapped up, but they were unearthed at when they were doing excavations at downtown in the 70s. So there is evidence of this. So that's another, this just sort of weird, kooky little town that also has these underground tunnels in it. And nobody really knows why they're there. Like, but anyways, there were all these rumors for years that there was these coven of witches and they did these sacrifices and stuff at these three cemeteries that form this perfect triangle all through Whitewater. And I took my buddies to these three cemeteries, and obviously the creepiest one, like I was saying, is right next to the water tower, not too far from like the college. And there's a lot of like weird stuff there. There's like this perfectly maintained Jesus statue on the cross there, and it's right next to this red headstone that just says Faust on it, right? And this is really interesting too, because in the legend of Romulus and Remus, you know, after they're suckled by the she-wolf, they're found by some herdsmen who help raise them. And the herdsman specifically who takes them in is named Faustius. Mm. So wow. Keep that in mind. That is so, you crazy. Know, there's just a lot of these really weird you know, graves there. Some of them have got like Jesuit markings. There's a lot of weird Celtic stuff there, like a lot of solar crosses and some other things like that. As we're like almost ready to leave, I know, because I've been to this graveyard a couple of times now, and I noticed something that I had never seen before, and it was these reliefs on this like almost like picture looking thing. Like, you know, it wasn't a grave, it was just sort of randomly set in amongst the graves. It was made of like marble and what have you, and it was of what appeared to be these images of a green man, but it was in this wolf form. And this was really like weird, man, because like nagged at me, you know, a, just the fact that we found this, because it was just insane, you know. I mean, it was just sort of randomly sitting here in this graveyard. And it didn't seem like there was any reason for it to be there, but it was obviously very expensive. It was very old. It had been there for a long time. You know, I mean, it's like this giant face or something like that with these, you know, I mean, pan-like, but almost green man and wolf form images on it. And I kept nagging at it. I'm like, well, I think I've seen these before somewhere. And then it had dawned on me, they were in Linda Godfrey's book, actually, the one that she'd written on the Beast of Bray Road. So I had the copy with me, went through it. And sure enough, there is this town, Palmyra, which is actually right between Whitewater and Elkhorn. And it's all sort of interconnected too with the Kettle Moraine State Park system. And some farmers living in Palmyra had found reliefs just like the ones that we were seeing in the cemetery on their property not far from the Kettle Moraine, right? And this had really driven Godfrey nuts too, because she thought she had seen them before. And then in her book, she writes about how she had gone through, like, you know, a lot of her different files. And then it finally occurred to her, she had seen him in Prague on this ancient Gothic cathedral there. The same type of green man release, but the green man almost in this wolf-like form. And they were almost exactly like the ones in Palmyra, almost exactly like the ones that we saw in this graveyard in Whitewater, right?
Wow.
And that had like reminded me of something else too that Godfrey had gotten into in the book, which was that there have been reports since the late 80s, early 90s of a lot of cult activity as well in the Kettle Moraine system. So, you know, they had found like all of these animal bones and stuff like that. And I, you know, obviously I built a decent amount of friends in Wisconsin. I asked some people who had grown up in that area, and they told me that was absolutely true. There, you know, you go back into Kettle Moraine, you'd find these dead animals that have been mutilated and stuff all the time, and all these occult symbols and stuff like that. They did this documentary not too long ago on the Beast of Bray River. They had this, I think it was a park ranger for the Kettle Moraine at the time, and he said that they were putting out the second highest amount of reports of occult activity in the late 80s than anywhere in the entire country, right? So, and this is all sort of unfolding right in this whole area where, you know, you've got the Beast of Bray Road and all this other stuff. And I mean, it was interesting, you know, we went out to Bray Road, we drove around, you know, and my buddy got just a sense of this like one area. And when we went back and we looked at it on a map, you know, it almost looks, because this whole area with Bray Road, like it's like mostly like farmland, but there's this one specific area which is actually near where the Bray family resides, that's still trees and what have you. And it really looks like the trees were cultivated so that they would look like a wolf from the air, which is interesting because, you know, again, especially if you know the mounds in Wisconsin too, the effigy mounds, like they're almost all designed to be seen from the air. I mean, there's like a bunch of Thunderbird ones. There's actually the Green Man or whatever it is, the like 50, 60 foot tall humanoid one. So it's very in keeping with that. And again, this is a state that was a part of the Northwest Territory. Once again, Society of Cincinnati members played a big role and founding it and what have you. And, you know, again, it's like we're going around, we're finding traces of this pottery. I mean, almost showing this pan-like figure, I mean, but in wolf, you know, almost werewolves get up. We found this thing with Bray Road, I mean, with the tree line and what have you. And then, of course, the whole tradition of, like, the Beast of Bray Road and all this other crazy stuff. And it just, you know, I mean, these rumors about this cult from Whitewater. And again, Whitewater was established by New England Yankees too. That's kind of another thing, which was really the heart of the Society of Cincinnati's like territory. So, you know, it does bring up like a lot of questions. I mean, are these possibly even traces of some of these folk cults or something like that?
It makes me wonder if there's any connection to what people are perceiving as dogmen sightings, if there could be any connection to some of these cults and shapeshifters or some kind of ritualistic aspect that allows a person to shapeshift into a wolf.
Yeah, or I mean, is it related to some kind of like ritual involving entheogens or something like that? Right, because right. I mean, again, like you were saying, you know, you have the similar sort of traditions with the Native Americans and whatnot. And it seems, at least in the case of some of the mound building civilizations like the Adena and Hopewell, they definitely had traditions involving the use of like mushrooms and what have you for some of their rites. So,
right.
Yeah. I mean, there's just I mean, a lot of incredible stuff about this. I mean, there really is. But I mean, the fact that, and sort of like my journeys, I mean, I had almost inadvertently stumbled over this whole notion of like this wolf cult that may trace, you know, I mean, really all the way back to earliest recorded history with the Indo-Europeans, I mean, going all the way through ancient Greece, through ancient Rome, and then possibly being recreated in North America by the Society of Cincinnati. I mean, again, it was quite a mind trip of this journey that I've been on with all this stuff, man, that's for sure.
Right on. And there may even be possible connections, you said, to ritualistic killings, maybe even some serial killers.
Well, yeah, because again, you got to remember Wisconsin's big smiley face territory, and that's kind of another weird sink, you know, with the howling. You know, of course, LaCrosse, the two detectives, Gannon and I think Gilbride or whatever, who had looked at this for a lot of years, they thought LaCrosse, Wisconsin, was kind of the hay, was a major region for the smiley killers, because so many victims were found within around the roughly 2 mile radius. Now, LaCrosse is on the western side of Wisconsin. This region is on the eastern side. They're kind of outside of that 2 hour radius. But it's interesting because I think at least two or three of the smiley face victims actually did come from Whitewater, remarkably. And there were several of them that had gone to this one, like five victims that all went to like the same high school in the same area, too. So that's sort of another weird thing about this, is it's like even though the smiley face killings were more in the western part of the state and some of the surrounding states, it does seem like a disproportionate amount of the victims came from this region. And, you know, again, this sort of is an interesting thing with the profile of the smiley face victims, allegedly, because a lot of them were, you know, younger men in the prime of their youth. You know, a lot of them were considered to be both exceptional athletes and students. And I haven't had a chance to look into this as much as I would like, but there are indications that a higher than average percentage of them were gifted kids and probably in some kind of gifted program as well. So, you know, this is like an interesting aspect of that. And again, if you subscribe to the sacrificial killings in the context of some things at the beginning of that, you know, brings up a lot of interesting things. But, you know, beyond that, obviously Jeffrey Dahmer, I mean, he was active in Milwaukee. I mean, he's also in this whole region. And I mean, there's the strange thing with cannibalism, all the stuff associated with that too. Slenderman, actually, the creator of Slenderman is like based was based out of this whole area too. And the well, the actual murder that the kid, you know, the two teenage kids tried to do in honor of Slenderman happened in Waukesha, which is what, like 45 minutes, I think, from Elkhorn. It's in a different county, but I mean, it's right there in that same area. So, you know, you can look at this and definitely see, I think, strong indications that there has been, you know, an effect on the broader region at the very minimum, I think, maybe from some of these rituals.
Yeah, man. This is so interesting. Fantastic research, Stephen. We're going to have to do this again soon. Before you head out, let everyone know where they can find out more about you, look into some of the stuff you're working on, all the good stuff.
All right. Well, like I said before, I'm the longtime curator of the Visit blog. That's VISUPVIEW, all one word, dot blogspot, all one word as well, dot com. And also, you can find me at the Farm Podcast. Just do a Google search of the Farm Mach 2 podcast or the Farm Mach 2, I think, dot com. And that's with the II, not, you know, the actual two. And also the Farm Patreon. Like I said, you get pretty much all of the podcasts, even the subscriber ones there. You get all these updates on my ongoing adventures on the road, insights into the research that I'm doing. And, you know, especially I love to photograph and film a lot of these regions. So, you know, if you actually want to see images of some of these things that I found in Wisconsin, they're up in the subscriber section. And I'm going to have a lot of big rollout stuff in the Society of Cincinnati and all this other stuff on the Patreon. So give that a thought. And also the author of Strange Tales of the Parapolitical, Postwar Nazis, Mercenaries, and Other Secret History, and A Special Relationship, Trump, Epstein, and the Secret History of the Anglo-American Establishment, which are available on Amazon and all fine online book retailers.
Awesome, man. Fantastic. We will definitely be doing this again soon. And until next time, everyone, have an excellent evening. We will speak again tomorrow. We will see y'all then.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.